Sunstone does not necessarily endorse the opinions expressed in these presentations, nor the character of the presenters. Presenters must follow Sunstone's code of conduct, available online at bit.ly/sunstoneconduct. Those who violate it are thereafter banned from Sunstone events. Since this session was recorded, multiple people reported having been sexually abused by panelist Tom Kimball. To provide opportunities to learn from the past and to keep the historical record intact, Sunstone will continue to make this session available. For more information, visit sunstone.org/connect/news. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673.
Thank you so much for coming to our panel today. I'm very surprised and heartened and encouraged to see this large audience. Just so we're clear, this is the panel on Mormon publishing and not the cooler panels that are going on elsewhere. So feel free if you need to. My name is Jana Reese, and I'm going to spend just the first couple of minutes laying the land for what's going on in publishing more generally right now. And then I'm going to introduce our three panelists who will talk about Mormon publishing in particular, and I'd like to leave a good amount of time for questions at the end. Let me just take a quick straw poll and find out a little bit about you. How many people here are writers, whether you're published or not? Okay. That's good. That's good to know, because we can certainly tailor our comments to the kinds of things that you might be interested in and also leave extra time for questions about the whole publishing process, about how to contact an editor, you know, any of the nuts and bolts things that may be things that you're interested in for your career. So a little bit of my background in history. I came to publishing by way of graduate school, which is not necessarily the usual way, but when you think about the number of academics who train for academic jobs and then the number of academic jobs that actually exist, they have to go elsewhere. And I was one of those people. But I love it. I have never regretted that move to publishing. I worked for 9 years as the religion book review editor for Publishers Weekly magazine, and PW is basically the national magazine of publishing and bookselling in this country. And so during the course of that almost decade, just about every religion book that was published in North America came to my house, which was a great experience and a good opportunity to see what was going on in publishing across the board. We had small presses, we had major trade houses, we had Buddhist publishers, we had evangelical Christian publishers, and so getting a sense of what was going on with them. About a year ago, though, I left PW because of the economy and because I could kind of see the writing on the wall. PW, if you subscribe to it or if you read it, you've seen that it kind of is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The ads are disappearing, and this is not unusual to PW, but is pretty pretty much an epidemic in the magazine industry everywhere right now. And so I decided to go work for a publishing company, and I now work as an acquisitions editor for Westminster John Knox Press, which is a religious press that specializes in biblical studies and theology, as well as some books for laity, especially pop culture, which is what I'm particularly focusing on. You might have heard of The Gospel According to the Simpsons, Gospel According to Peanuts. We do all of those books. Let me tell you a little bit about what's going on in publishing right now. If you are an author, it's a very challenging time. It's especially a challenging time to be a first-time author because more than ever before, your content, it's a given that you have to have great content. But what you also have to have these days is a platform. And your platform is essentially your ability to sell the book. Your speaking engagements, your professional networks, your teaching, the workshops that you lead, the blog that you write. You know, promoting your books is actually, at least for successful authors, which most of us are not, but for successful authors, promoting the books is a full-time job. And so more than ever before, the economy and the sort of squeeze that's going on in publishing has put the onus on the author for promotion. And I think also one other thing that's going on across the board is lists are getting smaller. For example, at the publishing house where I work, for the last couple of years, we've been doing between 90 and, well, maybe between 85 and 100 books each year. And next year, we're going to do 70. Well, that's 15 to 30 authors that won't be published by us. But when you multiply that contraction across the board by all kinds of different publishing houses, you start to see as an author how much more challenging it is to get started in this kind of publishing environment. So that's what's going on the publishing side. Also, there are huge problems in traditional bookselling and the retail side of this equation, which affect everything. And it's something that authors don't necessarily think about or see. You know, when you walk into Barnes & Noble, you don't necessarily think about all the books that aren't on the shelves. About 500,000 books are going to be published in one way or another in this country this year, which is an astonishing figure and is actually double what it was about 5 years ago. Anybody hazard a guess as to why? Self-publishing, that's right. Self-publishing is an increasingly viable option, or small vanity presses are an increasingly viable option because the technology is so incredible and so quick, making books available so quickly now. But they don't get into stores, and it's very, very difficult to get a self-published or a book from a really tiny press into a major trade bookstore or a chain like Barnes & Noble. And meanwhile, the chains are having huge problems because of this big online retailer called Amazon, which is changing everything for everybody and offers huge discounts to consumers, but those discounts come from somewhere, and they come from the pockets of publishers and authors. So, you know, it's a bit of a two-edged sword. Where is all this going to shake out? If I had a crystal ball, I would let you know, but unfortunately I don't. I can give you my best guess after a decade in the business, which is that two things. The first is that in terms of content, we're going to see more and more small niches for content. And that's actually a really good thing for Mormon authors. I think we'll hear some of the issues in the Mormon market are the complete dominance, not only on the publishing side, but also on the retail side of Deseret Book. And the monopoly that Deseret Book really has on the LDS market is unparalleled anywhere else that I witnessed in religious publishing, which is great for Deseret Book, and it certainly contributes to a sense of uniformity. But as we know, here at Sunstone, the uniformity that appears on the surface of the Mormon monolith is actually far, far more complicated. And it's very difficult for other voices to be published in this market because they can't get into stores. So we'll talk about that. So the rise of niching would be the first of the two major trends that I'm seeing in the future. I think that the second one is going to be the democratization of publishing. And that's going to come out in a lot of different formats. First is people who are just going to publish their books online and charge for them directly, which we're already seeing a lot of. And that is a successful business model for some authors, especially authors who already have a niche following. I encountered one author who was basically a gardening expert and created a blog where she blogged about what region of gardening she was in, but, you know, a very specific niche market. I'm a region 6 gardener, or zone 6, or whatever they call that. And so she developed this following of other people who were gardeners in that same zone, and then she published a book, and she immediately had her built-in audience. And she decided that it was more economically viable for her to do that herself than it would be to go with a traditional publishing house. You know, different kinds of books have different kinds of expectations, and a book like that is very, very dependent on photographs, and that's really expensive to produce traditionally, but it's not at all expensive to do online. So we're going to see a lot of democratization of publishing. We're going to see the rise of a number of smaller presses with very tiny print runs who can use print-on-demand technology to their advantage. Chris, I hope we'll talk about that. Let me just introduce our three panelists and let them go to town, and then we'll leave a good amount of time for questions at the end. So Chris Bigelow is the founder of Zarahemla Books, and they do both fiction and nonfiction, I think.
Mostly fiction and memoir.
Mostly fiction and memoir. And actually, memoir is the way that Chris first came to my attention. A number of years ago, my agent at that time sent me a memoir that she was having a hard time getting published. And by the way, this is a good lesson for everyone. It is so hard to publish a memoir. So if you're thinking of writing one, just know that it's a very uphill battle. So she sent me this memoir because she knew I was LDS, and it was from an LDS author. And so I read this, and I thought it was so beautiful and fresh and really intelligent and funny. And I had some suggestions about places to try to get it published, but I think the big thing that came out of that is the friendship that Chris and I started. And then a couple of years later, maybe a year later, I was supposed to write this book called Mormonism for Dummies and had been in contact with the publishing house for quite some time about this, and it didn't seem to be going anywhere. And then finally, when they got back to my agent about it, they wanted it right away. They wanted the whole book within like 9 months. And I said to her, there's no way I could do this. And she suggested that that I work with Chris. I said, oh, well, that's brilliant. And so we wound up writing a book that was much better, I think, together than it was apart. And then Chris has gone on to work on many projects with Worth Press in Britain and some other adventurous things. And he's written a novel, and he's just amazing. All right, Greg Cofford here is the founder of Cofford Books. Many of you are familiar with that. And you have a table here, right, Greg?
Not this year.
Oh, not this year. Okay. Well, you can go online and check out their list. Greg also has a lot of experience having worked in Deseret Book, and I hope he can talk about that as well.
Siegel.
Oh, and Siegel. I'm sorry. And Siegel, which is now owned by Deseret because they've been slowly gobbling up everybody. And Tom Kimball here.
We're waiting to be gobbled up by Deseret Book.
Who's awaiting to go? Excellent. Yeah, let's just say Deseret Book is not the enemy here. I mean, there are absolutely some really wonderful products that come out from Deseret Book, and they are trying to survive a retail market that is very difficult, and they've found that one way to do this is to take independent retailers and offer them the brand name of Deseret Book, which is more profitable for them. So, you know, it's not like they're some really super evil bad guy. Just like, you know. Tom Kimball is with Signature Books, which is a small press here in Salt Lake City and has a venerable tradition of producing some alternate histories and some of the more controversial voices within Mormonism. But Tom has a remarkable ability to cultivate friendships and relationships on all sides of the equation, and you know, hanging out with people from Deseret and from Sunstone together. So he's a very balanced kind of person.
Yes.
Yeah. And I will let all three of you riff at each other, because apparently Greg was the one who brought Tom Kimball into publishing. I don't know that story, but maybe he'll be prevailed upon to tell it.
Wow, we've been doing this publishers panel in one way or another for 3 or 4 years, right, Tom? Me and you mostly. Here's the next We usually get about 6 people, so Jana. Mm-hmm. You have a magical personality. Not all these people, I guess, or something.
Chris and I are cousins, so it's kind of a family reunion.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I'm doing right now is called Zarahemla Books, and I consider it a small, kind of alternative Mormon publisher. And the key to success for me has been low overhead, low expectations. Honestly, because of digital printing, it's possible to do one book at a time. And the quality is pretty good now with digital printing. A lot of people that would pick up an ink and a toner-based book wouldn't necessarily notice the difference right off. So that's opened up all kinds of opportunities. And for me, the reason why I got into it was just because I was involved with the Association for Mormon Letters, which if you're not involved with it as a would-be writer, it's a great resource for you that I really recommend you look into. But through my connections with that organization, I was just aware of some manuscripts out there on Mormon themes, Mormon fiction, Mormon memoir, it just wasn't finding a home. It was a little too raw or edgy for Deseret to do. Signature actually was doing some, but not a lot, like one or two slots a year for novels if we're lucky. So limited opportunities at Signature. And just really not a lot of other places to put it. It's really hard to place a Mormon-flavored manuscript with a national publisher, although I think it's worth trying. So anyway, I started Verehem to get some of these manuscripts out there. And we've done about 10 books so far. And you know, when I say low expectations, if we sell 100 copies of a book, we can break even on cost, and we can feel quite satisfied that that's better than nothing. You know, 100 copies, it sounds low, but it's fun. It's still a lot of fun. And you still can get reviewed in regional newspapers and Mormon alternative periodicals, and you can still feel like you are making a real contribution to Mormon letters. And of course, we've had a couple of titles that have, for us, I say taken off, but it's still, we're talking about 2,000 copies, but hey, that was thrilling for us. That was actually Doug Thayer. He came to me for some reason, Tom. I don't know why. He used to publish with you guys. And so I'm here as a resource if you have questions about this Mormon niche market I'm trying to serve, if you have questions about digital publishing or how to get distribution within the Mormon market or just direct to Mormon-oriented readers, I'm here as a resource and probably leave most of that for Q&A, I guess.
I grew up in Mormon publishing. My father, when I was making the transition from Cub Scouts to Boy Scouts, got involved with Covenant, who is the number two publisher in the LDS market. It wasn't at the time that he got involved. He actually went to work for them. The main product, they just made a transition from the Book of Mormon on 33 and a third records to putting it on cassettes, just, you know, cutting-edge stuff. And they also did a smattering of general authority talks, Hubie Brown, Matthew Kelly, and then I'm sure everybody's favorite, Paul Dunn. And they made a fair amount of money on a relative scale doing those things. So I grew up in Mormon publishing. My first real job was actually running a small machine that wound the magnetic tape inside of cassettes. And I grew up with that. I grew up with the concept that, you know, Deseret Book was the arch enemy, but also, you know, the business that determined whether you were going to live or die or have a Christmas or not. So it's been an interesting experience. I came back to Utah after a career in finance in the early 90s, and my father, in an attempt to increase the distribution for Covenant, had started Siegel Book. And when I arrived on the scene, they had three stores, a couple of franchisees, and he was talking about possibly bankrupting Siegel because it wasn't working out like he had envisioned. I thought it might be interesting to get involved in actually running a business instead of, in essence, playing Space Invaders for money all day, which is, you know, what I do in the financial arena. So I took over management of Siegel Book, and over the next couple of years built it up into 10 stores, got revenue up over the $5 million mark, pushed it into profitability, and was able to build a solid foundation for Siegel's continued growth, and in turn, hand in hand, that pulled Covenant along with it, because obviously we stocked a fair amount of Covenant product. As most of you are probably aware, almost 2 years ago, my dad sold out both Siegel and Covenant to Deseret Book. I'd like to personally thank each one of you for your tithing dollars that have gone to my father's retirement fund. But in the process of watching that, it was interesting because, as Jana mentioned, Deseret Book has a virtual monopoly in both publishing and retailing, and especially when they purchased Covenant and Siegel. Wholesale-wise, they probably dominate literally 80-85% of the wholesale sales in the market, and that's counting sales to their retail stores. On the retail side, it's probably a similar number. They dominate 80-85% of the retail market. But it's interesting because they are, in essence, a bureaucracy owned by a bureaucracy. And in the true spirit of monopolies owned by bureaucracies, they don't know how to make money. They struggle constantly to figure that out, which runs counter to your basic economic theory of when you have a monopoly, you have to figure out how not to make so much money so people don't get out of step. They've conquered that dilemma. In fact, when the discussions first started about buying Siegel, they were sure that Siegel, it was precipitated by a decision of Deseret Book to stop shipping product to Siegel. And ostensibly, their reason of doing that, which they stated, and it actually ended up getting quite a bit of media coverage, but their ostensible reason for cutting off Siegel at that juncture was that Siegel was not properly displaying the promotional materials Deseret Book was distributing with their books. They weren't hanging up the posters. They didn't have enough bookmarks by the cash register. Now, granted, you know, the Deseret Book was selling to Sam's Club, to Walmart, and I've yet to see a poster or a bookmark at Walmart, but that was a separate and distinct case Deseret Book maintained. But what became apparent was that they firmly believed that by cutting off Siegel, that they would be able to push Siegel into bankruptcy and, you know, get rid of this terrible thorn in their foot that just, you know, was living hell for them. It shortly became obvious that wasn't going to quite work because they didn't realize that Siegel operated on a different retail mentality or philosophy than Deseret. And when you're a brick and mortar bookstore, there's two philosophies that you can stock your stores under. One is that, and this is generally the model that B. Dalton, Walden, Barnes & Noble, you know, Books a Million, they all kind of follow this philosophy, and that's that we're going to stock what the consumer wants. We recognize that there's probably 20 titles, the best sellers, that are going to make up literally 70-80% of our sales in a given month, but we've got to have this appearance of variety of another 100,000 titles. And if you were to graph the sales of those titles, it looks like literally half of a bell curve. You know, you've got significant sales in those top 20 or so titles, and then it dribbles off slowly, but you get sales, you know, over a fair amount of titles in reasonable numbers. The other philosophy, which is one that Deseret Book was employing, was you're going to come to our bookstores to buy something, and if we only have Deseret Book product or product we choose to have, you're going to buy what we have. That dramatically impacts the amount of sales that occur. I'm sure you find that just an astounding principle, something I should write up and publish as this new novel, Retail Philosophy. But Deseret Book has constantly had that mentality in one flavor or another throughout its existence in retailing. And that, I believe, is a determining factor in profitability. You've got to sell what people want, not what you want them to buy. If everybody wants Coke and I've got Pepsi, it's a problem. So I've just been told I've got 1 minute. So anyway, I could go on for a long time with stories about this, but the industry, which is a niche within a niche, I think niche is too broad for Mormon Publishing, is going through some dramatic changes. This is the final indicator on that. The LDS Booksellers Convention this year was literally two-thirds the size of the previous year. So we've had a dramatic contraction in the number of wholesalers that can see their way to justify paying a whopping $425 to have a booth. So that kind of says something. In the last 5 years, you've had the number of retail stores who are paying dues to the LDS Booksellers has dropped from just under 500 if Desert Book signs up every one of their retail stores so they can dominate the votes and control the board, but if you count Desert Book as a single member of the LDS Booksellers Convention as a retailer, you have just about 100 retailers, down from almost 500 5 years ago. So you've seen some dramatic contractions.
When I was in the Middle East, I saw the soldiers were having a hard time getting the soldiers to hydrate, so they had to line them all up, and they gave them all a bottle of water, and they said, "Hold them up!" And they held the bottles of water up, and okay, down them, and they all had to drink water. That was how bad it was. Okay, everybody grab your pen, hold it up. Hold it up. Come on. Okay, get your piece of paper. Write this down. Breathe life into your life story. By Dawn and Morris Thurston. T-H-U-R-S-T-O-N. Benchmark Books has some copies. When they run out, they can order them for you. If you live out of state, they will mail them to you. We published a book on how to write stories that people will want to read. It's a guide, and it's a strategy. And I'm telling you, you know, in our office, we have a bunch of jaded editors and proofreaders and publishing folks. And I hear Ron, my boss, all the time saying, "It's just like the Thurston said in their book." If you want to write anything, you should have that book. It's a good guide. It'll walk you through some of the publishing, okay? The question you need to ask yourself as a potential author is why are you going to write the book? Are you a student of a subject? Are you just trying to get someone to give you critical feedback on subject so you'll know your subject better? Did you want to present yourself as the authority on the subject? Why are you writing the book and why are you writing the article? To me, when I wrote my little book, I wrote a little book on book collecting. The first time I wrote it, I had a grand distribution of 36 copies. And I gave them to the guys that I knew were in my book trade. And it was me discussing the terms of book selling and the book terms. And it was an awful little book. And I wrote it as a student. Everyone trashed me. And it was absolutely lovely. I learned, you know, I called the little primer I dedicated an advanced ED, advanced reading copy. It's not an advanced reading copy, it's an advanced reading copy. You know, those types of things. And you have to realize that when you publish
can
your book.
Someone, thank you.
Okay, hold your phones up.
Yes, everyone please turn off their phones or put them on the vibrate mode.
Everyone,
thank you.
Turn them off. Okay, sorry, I didn't have the phone. Sorry, that happens. It's okay. Mine went off on that last session. I've done worse. But anyway, the question is why are you writing the book? The second time I wrote the book, I took everybody's corrections and everybody's critiques, and I made corrections to my little book, and I did a grand publishing total of 100 copies,
hey.
And I gave most of them away because you know, no one wants to buy that book, And I had a lot of fun, and I only got a couple of critiques this next time. And that made me feel like, oh, I'm starting to figure out my trade, my craft, the thing that I was interested in. And that's why I wrote the book, because I wanted people to criticize what I was doing, because I wanted feedback. I wanted to know what I was doing wrong. And I think that's what a lot of people are trying to do with their books. And they don't want to really present themselves as the authority. They're writing the books because they want to learn, they want to know. I know recently when an interesting subject came up around the office about a historical topic, you know, as soon as someone said the topic, I just went, that can't be it. And I got grumbled a little bit, and Gary Bajer walked over, and we talked about it. And he said, "Tom, you know, I've thought about it, and here's these things, and you know, maybe that person's on to something." And you know, that made me think about what Gary's about, and I realized, you know, Gary's a student. He's a student of this. He loves this stuff. And if someone can show that he's wrong, that's great news. You know, and so that's something to think about. And that's an important part with regards to publishing, because there's the issue of an editor. You can publish a book We'll talk about how to get a book published in a minute, and that's kind of it's an important issue. But the question is what are you doing it for, and what did you want to present? And without an editor telling you what you're doing wrong, the book's going to suffer in its quality, and that's where the publishers come in. If you're doing a historical or biographical piece or a theological piece or whatever, and you're trying to do a big piece, one of the ideas, one of the strategies that we recommend or that I recommend to authors is take a chapter of your book or turn it into an article and submit it to the Journal of Mormon History or Dialogue or Sensen or some other journal. And when they send you back your manuscript, and it's got all those margin notes, and they're telling you what you've done wrong, we'd like to see this corrected, we'd like to see that. This is good news. They're helping you. Don't be married to what you wrote. Okay? Because they're not trying to tell you you're a bad person, they're not trying to tell you you're stupid. They're trying to help you. And we certainly, as Signature Books, want our authors to be used to going through the editing process. Because if you hand in a book and you're married to the way that those words are put together, we have a pretty heavy hand on our stuff. And you're not going to have a happy time with us. And you're not going to have a happy time with a lot of publishers. Even our own employees who have published through us have to have an editor kicking the crap out of what the other person what they wrote, even though they're a seasoned editor. And that's because you need someone else to give you a second perspective, or a third or a fourth, to tell you what you're doing wrong. And that's one of the problems with self-publishing. You're struggling to get someone to tell you how you're struggling linguistically, grammatically. I wrote, this is our catalog, okay? I wrote a lot of the text, and I'm telling you, I'm not a great writer, but when Ron got through with it, and Janie got through with it, and Gary cut it in half, and George, called me on the carpet on a couple things, okay? I turned out having there's some pretty good writing in here. And it's not because I'm a good writer. It's because I have good editors and have good critics. So I hope that we get back to the issue of publishing.
Well, that's actually my next question.
Thank you.
For the next question, I would like each panelist to speak for just 2 to 3 minutes on specifically Mormon publishing. Greg, you touched on this already. What's going on right now in Mormon publishing? Greg and I have talked a little bit about the 85-15 rule, and I hope that you will elaborate on that and what that means for Mormon authors. And also Tom and Chris, if you could talk about, Tom, you were experienced as a bookseller as well, which you have not really discussed with us yet, but if you could talk about your experiences in getting books into stores specifically and the challenges that you are facing right now.
Let me go first.
Whoever wants to.
It's in front of you, though.
Go first. Best way to hide anything from Mormons is to publish it. That is the big problem is distribution, and it kind of goes hand in hand with the issue of if you're going to self-publish, bookstores want just a handful of receipts to pay every month. And I've been with panels of bookstores, and I've had a guy stand up and he said, I've got this widget, and I wanted to get in your store, and he explained the widget, and all the bookstore owners saying, that is a great widget, that is something that would sell my store, but you know what, I don't want another receipt, I don't want another invoice. So unless you can get into a distributor where I can order that amongst many, many other titles and many other things, I really don't have the time or the energy to deal with your invoice. So that is one of the issues they're going to deal with trying to get your books in the brick and mortar stores. The other problem is that it's hard to get your stuff into a distributor warehouse. Desert Book has even taken over the issue of being a distributor themselves and pulling in other titles, and so that's sort of being monopolized as well. And so, yeah, distribution is dismal. Really, in the end, our best distributors could be summed down to probably less than 10 vendors. And then just a handful of really, really small ones after that.
The 85-15 thing that John was referring to is As I mentioned, Deseret Book will have various flavors of this. We're going to sell you what we want you to buy, opposed to retailing. Earlier this year, I was told by some Deseret Book employees that they had formally instituted a policy with the buyers that they were to have an 85% Deseret Book covenant product and 15% other product, and which dramatically curtailed the amount of titles that they've been ordering from publishers like us. When I've asked that formally of the buyers, they've denied that that rule is in place. Although I've noticed a dramatic uptick in Deseret Book's interest in our particular product line since they hired my brother to be their head of internet marketing. So, again, you know, proving that it's not what you know, it's who you know. So, but the thing to remember about Mormon Publishing is, as an author, the stark reality is the odds of you making a living, even a modest living, or even some money that's going to buy you a decent vacation, are extremely low. In the Mormon world, a bestseller is considered to be 50,000 copies. Invariably, that title is going to be a fiction novel, and odds are it's a Mormon romance novel. I know that sounds like an oxymoron. I had a fellow that worked for me for a while. I hired him when he was still in college, and I was explaining to him the lay of the land in Mormon publishing and told him this, and he looked at me and goes, "A Mormon romance novel? I just can't picture that." I said, "Okay, let me give you a typical plot line. And if you want to steal as a publisher, feel free." So I said to Andy, this woman is married to a good man. It's been a decent marriage, but he's just not bishop or stake president material, so she's extremely frustrated. He fortuitously is killed in a car accident. And at the funeral, she happens to meet a man who has just received a call to be a mission president, but is going to have to turn it down because his wife just died of cancer. So they, of course, unite and march off to be mission presidents together. And Andy looked at him and he goes, "My mother would buy that book." But the amount of the predominant titles that are sold in the LS market are fiction. That doesn't mean that there's not a market for, you know, other types. We don't do fiction. I love fiction. I read fiction. I'm just not interested in doing Mormon fiction right now. That could change in the future, but that's not something that we do. But Chris had mentioned possibly looking at national publishers, and that's an uphill road. I'm sure as you're aware, there have been a number of LDS titles, particularly by President Hinckley, that were published by national imprints. But it's interesting, if you understand the back side of that, or the dark side, depending on how you want to look at it, all of those were, in essence, vanity publications. Even the Encyclopedia of Mormonism was a vanity publication. All of those Hinckley titles and the Encyclopedia of Mormonism were published on the condition that Deseret Book issue a very, very, very large purchase order for the vast majority of the print run of each one of those titles that was non-returnable. And if you were able to get into Deseret Book's warehouse today, there's a couple of those Hinckley titles, they've got some fairly large amounts still that, I don't know what they're going to do with them, but... So that you might have a perception, that we're breaking out into the national market. That national imprint has been bought and paid for. The book that's probably sold the most recently that was done by a national house that was not a vanity press would be Rough Stone Rolling by Richard Bushman. And that has done very, very well. And that was a straight-up publishing deal, and Knopf took the risk on that. So I'll pass it to Chris.
Well, let me just tell you a little bit about what I've done with Zarah Himmler that kind of touches on what Jana was asking. For one thing, to become a real publisher doesn't take a whole lot. What it really boils down to is having your own ISBN number. You know, those barcodes that go on the back of books. You can buy them in blocks as low as 10 ISBN numbers as your own publisher so that it appears to the whole book publishing trade that you are a publisher, and that's about $250 to buy a block of 10 ISBNs, and then you're a publisher, basically. And you can start using digital printing, and you can, if you use the right digital printer, any bookstore in the United States can order your book. And so that's the route I've taken. But trying to get into the modern market, let me tell you some of the things I've tried to do. First of all, of course, you have to make sure your books are online on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And that's a pretty good... Mormons do buy Mormon books increasingly through those channels, and that's been good. But of course, you really want to try to get into stores if you can, too. And I've jumped through a lot of hoops as a small little publisher to try to get into the bookstores. I joined the LDS Booksellers Association, paid the membership fees, I think they're $100 a year, and then you can get their list of retailers if you get a booth at their convention or if you want to pay extra. And I got the list of retailers with all their contact information, and I went ahead and I printed up extra copies of some titles and just mailed out sample copies to all of these independent bookstores and Deseret Book. And then, you know, you just have to do a lot of grunt work. You start calling to follow up. You say, did you get the book? And here's what we're doing with promotion. And here's some great reviews that have come out. It takes a ton of work and a ton of time to do. But it is doable. And when I say it's doable, you know, you can do it. The returns on it, in terms of how many bookstores are willing to order, there are some. And, you know, we've sold a few hundred copies of different titles through doing that. But that at some point, you want to try to see if you can get a distributor. And there are two or three LDS distributors beyond Deseret. They're called Granite and Sounds of Zion and Brigham Distributing. These are three independent distributors. And Granite and Brigham both say that they really want to help small publishers distribute their books to the Mormon market. So if you can invest a little money to get a decent cover and have your book well edited, these distributors will do their best to help you out. However, they still may only sell a few dozen or hundred copies of your book. So it is possible to do. But like I say, keeping expectations low helps out. And if you happen to get lucky and have something catch on, then you can respond to it. But, you know, it can be discouraging when you look at the actual numbers. But if there's something going on, to me, that's enough to keep me going. And I think that's the right attitude with small-scale publishing is any progress is good progress, and keep at it. And you may break through with something that keeps you going for another couple of years or more, with financially and otherwise. So,
all right, thank you. I would like to ask each of you again 2 to 3 minutes on what is the worst challenge facing you in this economy, and how has the recession affected publishing? How might it affect authors right now?
Well, my worst challenge is that I got a bunch of books back from one of the distributors that took them. We're only talking about 200 books that they just said, we've had them in the warehouse and we're ready to not have them there anymore, so we're giving them back to you. And they haven't even paid for them. They were on consignment. So I had paid for them and let them hold them on consignment. But, you know, I get all these books back and I got to figure out what to do with them. And if they have paid for them, which sometimes happens, then you have to give them their money back. And that can just... One bad move in terms of overprinting a book and over shipping it and having it come back, can just totally sink a small company. One bad move, I think, can do it.
You know, I just want to interject something in here. Greg referred to returnable merchandise, and publishing is different from almost any other business in that it still runs on a so-called gentleman's agreement, that when a bookstore orders a book, they're under no financial obligation to actually pay for that book. Not only can they return it at any time for a full refund, but often the distributor or publisher will pay for the shipping. So there's almost no financial risk to bookstores unless it's under some sort of agreement like Greg was talking about with Deseret Book and the Gordon B. Hinckley titles, where they wrote into the agreement from the beginning that this would be non-returnable merchandise. So the financial risk in publishing is really huge.
So that, yeah, that's the biggest challenge, I think.
Well, I had a buddy who sells sunglasses, okay, and he buys the sunglasses for, $3, and he sells them for $20 or $40, and his margins are just huge, okay? You publish a book, and, the publisher's $18 into the book itself, and they're retailing it for, $20 to $30. The margins are very, very small. And if they return the books to you, if you send them 1,000 books and they return 500 of them to you and they're damaged and there's a problem there, it could put a company under. So that is a problem. Another issue with regards to problems we're facing is that the really good independent bookstores where the people actually sat around and read the books and enjoyed what they were doing, they're in the business because it was fun, not because they were trying to make $1 million. Those shops are all closing. And when I worked at Deseret Book, I couldn't read everything, but I really liked to read. And there was this little book that came in. It was a Deseret Book title, so I was being faithful to the company. It's called, by Heidi Swinton, it's called Pioneer Spirit, and came in. I read it and had these short little vignettes of missionary narratives, modern pioneers was the thing. These short little vignette stories that you could use for church talks and stuff. It was a cool little book, and people would come in and what's new? I'd walk over and show them and read one of the stories. It took a minute to read one of the stories to people, and they liked it. And I hand sold 300-400 copies of the book, and it was fun. And it was an expensive book. And then one day, I ran out and didn't have any, so I went and checked the inventory of all the other stores, and I was really kind of shocked to see that out of the 30 stores, the most any other store had sold was 5 copies. And, if you have one, even just one kid up there in a bookstore who really loves your book and is telling everybody who walks in the door about the book, it means all the difference. And let's say you had 20 guys like that who just liked your book. And every time someone came in, they just said, you know what? This is a great title. We should grab it. When I was at Deseret Book, I had 50 employees in me. And none of them read. I had one guy who liked fiction. I had one lady who liked, Deep Into the Ocean, the... Women's fiction, or some of the more popular New York Times bestseller type stuff, and she did a pretty good job of selling that. But as far as Mormon history, I was it, and I was the lead supervisor, so I still had to manage employees and do all that kind of stuff. So, in my mind, it's the loss of the independent bookstores where you had people who were sitting in the bookstore who, when no one was around, they were sneaking a read of a book, and when people walked in, they're saying, here's my best story. Okay, I walk into Pioneer Book, and there's Bruce McDaniel sitting behind the counter, and he puts the book down, and he says, I read 100 books this year, and that's the best one. I went, is it for sale? Yeah! $20. No problem, it really was. It was a great book. There's not that going on out there.
One of the advantages that I have is I do Greg Hilford books out of passion. It's not a livelihood for me. Having said that, I'm not really interested in paying for that passion. So I've managed to figure out how to run the business with some marginal profitability most of the time. But I would say with the economic downturn, what I've noticed, we went through an initial wave, as Chris talked about, of returns from the distributors. With us, it was mostly the national guys. Typically with Ingram and Baker and Taylor, and those are the two dominant distributors nationally, the arrangement with the publisher is they'll buy the book at this horrendous discount where you make virtually nothing on it, and then they'll get around to looking at paying you 90 days later. Now, although they're supposed to pay 90 days, they start looking at it in 90 days. Then they barely come back, and they want proof of delivery, and they want this, and they want that. And you go through, you know, some machinations there, and after the accounting paper has pulled out their hair, maybe 20, 30 days later, so you're now out 120, sometimes 150 days, they'll actually cut you a check. But what they'll do is they'll take books that, you know, invoices that are 4 or 5 months old, and they'll do a return, and they'll apply that return they did today that you haven't even received yet against the check that they're writing for a book that you shipped them 5 months ago. So we saw this big wave of returns, and then they probably, you know, reordered all that stuff over the next 2 weeks. But, you know, and they went through this game where it was like for the first half of the year, they didn't want to ever write a check. They always wanted a return. But as they kept selling down the inventory, that became a problem because you got to have inventory to sell. So, you know, they find it looks like that's kind of evened out now, and they're back to business as usual. The thing that I've noticed with Siegel and Deseret Book is the buyers became much more attuned to inventory turns. And what that is it's the dollar amount of sales you have divided by the amount of inventory divided by your sales. So if you have 100,000 in inventory and you do 100,000 in sales, you have one times inventory turn. Everybody in bookstore world is trying to get to, you know, 3 or 4 times inventory turn. Amazon seems to keep trying to hit, you know, 27 or 28. But the buyers of the big chains became much more attuned to that. We were able to circumvent most of that through creative financing on the invoices. Since they all of a sudden, you know, oh gosh, I don't want to carry this book because it only got a couple of, you know, turns a year. Well, what if we just give you a 90-day invoice on it? Oh, okay, fine. So we were able to get around most of that, but it was understanding initially what they were trying to accomplish. So.
Okay. Last question, and then we're going to open it up for audience questions. When you're looking, when you're receiving manuscripts, this is more for Chris and Tom, and I guess for me a little bit, but when you're receiving manuscripts, what is it that authors are doing that is utterly stupid? What do you think is the greatest mistake that authors are making in trying to contact you? I only ask this question because I already have an answer. Please don't ever tell me that you're going to be on Oprah. I'm so tired of hearing that. People have no inkling how difficult it is to get on a national TV show. And it just shows how utterly clueless you are. So please don't ever do that.
Ugh.
I'm the marketing guy. I'm not necessarily the manuscript guy. So all I can really say is what people call in all the time. They've got a history of their grandmother or grandfather or whatever, and then they're trying to get it published. I guess that the people should understand that the publisher is going to spend a significant amount of capital on the book, and if they haven't done anything preparatory work, trying to get the book, a section of the book already published through a journal or somewhere else, and trying to get a little bit of experience before coming to us, that really kind of wasting our time.
I sure have learned a lot as starting out as an author in primary focus and then getting into publishing. My goodness, I sure understand a lot more about how I was treated as an author now that I've done the publishing side, because those unsolicited submissions that come in from would-be authors has turned out to be my least favorite part of the enterprise. And the reason is because there's so many of them and they eat up a lot of time to give them a thorough consideration. And then you're very careful to position your publishing company. We do this and this, we're not trying to do this, we're not trying to do this. But then you just get people who think, well, I'm going to send them my Mormon cookbook, recipe book, anyway, because maybe they'll like it. So you get authors who just are sending things in that you've already said that you don't want. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that authors make, is to put the time and effort into sending a manuscript somewhere that doesn't fit with what the publisher exists to do. And I'm getting to the point now where I've had some volunteer readers who help me screen manuscripts for Zarahemla, but I'm getting to the point now where for a manuscript to get on our radar, we kind of have to have outside experts vouch for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got to have an email coming from somebody whose reputation I sort of know, saying, I'm aware of this manuscript, and I really think you ought to read it. And I'm talking like a BYU professor, or a known critic, or a prominent blogger, who comes in and says, wake up call, this is worth consideration. Those are the ones I'm giving the time to now. And so I would recommend, if you're doing any kind of submitting, nationally or Mormon-wise, do that networking in advance and use those contacts.
I would say the biggest mistake to me that authors have done, and yes, I've had people do this, is to send in a manuscript and then with a cover letter or a phone call explaining that it's been revealed to you that I'm to be your publisher. Well, I had a woman who was adamant on her manuscript. She managed to get through my phone call filtering and explained that every word of her book had been revealed to her in the temple, and that when she finished it, you know, she had prayed to seek guidance, and it had been revealed to her that certain things would happen, and those things had happened with an employee of mine, and therefore she knew that I was to be the true publisher. So I simply responded. I said, well, gee, that's very interesting. I would assume that it would, of course, be natural protocol that God would let me know that, too. Right? She concurred, and so I meditated on it very briefly. When she called back, I explained to her that I felt very inspired that I was to be her publisher, but also that I was inspired that she should contribute $10,000 towards the publication. That didn't quite work the way I hoped, but the outcome was okay. She called me back and told me that she had gotten confirmation about the 10 grand, but her husband hadn't.
Addressed self-publishing real quick.
Sure.
This is reading the pen again. If you have a family history that you're just going to do it by yourself, and you realize that the publisher's not going to be able to do it for you, there are a couple of alternatives. There's a company called Lightning Source. It's in Laverne, Tennessee. And if you submit your book in typeset and with a cover. In their format, you can do this really quite cheaply. It's only like $200-$300, and you submit the PDF files and you send them the $300, and they will print one copy at a time. So let me give you this scenario: you have a biography of Uncle Ernie, and you submit it to Lightning Source, and you get it all set up on Lightning Source. Your cousin in Indianapolis goes on to Amazon. And Lightning Source will set this up on Amazon for you as part of the service fee. They order the book, okay? The order goes to Ingram. Ingram puts the order in across the street at Lightning Source. They print the book that day, the one copy. They walk it across the street to Ingram, and it goes off to Amazon to the people. And the average print run, they print about 20 to 30,000 books a day with an average print run of 1.8. So they're the king of printing one-offs. You know, my brother did a book a while back, and he had a company, you know, print 10,000 copies. He got on the UFO night shows with Art Bell and pitched his book there, and he got 50,000 orders on Amazon. And there were only 10,000 copies existed, and well, he probably got more than 50,000, but he actually ended up having to produce 50,000 copies to feed Amazon. It was kind of cool. But had he had it set up on Lightning Source, then all the orders that he missed, because it took 3 or 4 months for him to print enough books to fill all the orders, had it set up on Lightning Source, within 2 days, all of those books would have existed and would have been sent non-returnable to the people, and Lightning Source a month later would have just cut him a check. And it's that simple. You're not sitting with any books in your garage. You're sitting with this many books in your garage. Okay, whereas before he had 10,000 books sitting in his garage. Okay, that's one strategy, and that's a pretty good one if you're just going to do it yourself. As long as you fit their little format, their 6x9 format and all that, that's pretty good. The other one is there's a company in North Salt Lake, and there's a couple other companies that do this. It's just the one I use is DMT Press, Delta Michael Tango, DMT Press, and they'll do very small print runs. They'll do print. I have them to do as little as six, and you know, I go over Kinko's, and it'll cost me $300-$400 to print, you know, 10 copies of a manuscript. I can take the same $300-$400 over to DMT, and they'll do a couple hundred for me. You know, it's very inexpensive. The more you print, the cheaper it gets, of course. But they'll do 5 books for you, and they'll do them pretty inexpensively, and they'll do a pretty good job. And they'll actually do the typesetting and stuff for you. You can hire them to do the typesetting and all that. It's a pretty little, good little setup. To do a good paperback of your little book you're trying to do. There was a guy over there who did a print run. Show me now, sorry. A print run of just tithing houses. He was going to study tithing houses, and he, you know, had 20 pages on or 30 pages on tithing houses. Went over there and got 20 books made up and gave them to his buddies and his aunt and uncle and all that kind of stuff. It's a good way of getting yourself self-published.
Okay.
Your comments? You do some of that.
I use Lightning Source.
Yeah.
All right, thanks. Two comments also following up on what Tom said about self-publishing. Amazon got in trouble earlier this year because, as you know, Amazon wants to sort of have its fingers in every pie and hit upon self-publishing as a potentially profitable venture, but has been squeezing out people who self-publish in other venues. I don't know about Lightning Source, but some of the other companies, Amazon has refused to carry their stuff. So it's... self-publishers are now wondering, do I need to use Amazon exclusively for self-publishing so that Amazon will carry my book? Because when you self-publish, you have to have Amazon carry your book.
Yeah.
That's really the way you are going to find an audience is online. So I just wanted to say that. I also wanted to say to Greg, I'm so glad you brought up the God told me to write this book. God told me that you were going to be the publisher, because that happens all the time. You would be amazed. How often people send some variant of that letter. I got letters when I was at Publishers Weekly. The Virgin Mary said that you would be the one to review my book. Well, you know, she didn't come to me in my laundry and tell me that. So, you know, don't do that if you're an author. Keep it very professional and understand, even if you are writing a religious title, that the publisher is interested in this as a business. So good to keep that in mind. All right, I'd like to open this up for questions from the audience. Please come up to the microphone so that your question will be recorded. And also, I want to make it clear that sometimes when I speak at writers' conferences, writers by nature are loquacious, and questions tend to run a little long sometimes. Keep your question short, keep it to the point, and make sure you're not just telling your whole history of your book or your life story or whatever. Make sure there really is a short, concise question. Thanks.
Jan, this might be to you, although anybody's welcome to answer. I'm just trying to think of the days of Bennett Cerf running Random House. Things have changed a lot. What's happened to Random House and that old classic publisher? Where are we today?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, Random House is now the umbrella under which you now have Bantam, Doubleday, Dell, and a whole host of subsidiary things, smaller ones, Algonquin, for example, which specializes in literary fiction. And with all of this, Random House actually distributes a flowchart. When I was at PW, they sent me a handy little flowchart to show how all of these different imprints would fit into the larger publishing. But they're owned by Bertelsmann, which is a for-profit media company, and the pressure is enormous on a major trade house, like Random House in particular. The commercial pressure is such that if an author is lucky enough to have a book published by a major trade house, that can actually come back to bite you in the butt, because if you don't meet the sales expectations, which are enormous for your first book with a company like that, they drop you like a rock. And what has changed tremendously from those early days is that in the past, and really up until about 15 years ago, those large companies even would be committed to building an offer over the long term. We understand that we're going to start small and we're going to build the audience with each successive book, especially for novelists, especially for fiction. And now the expectation is this first book has to be a hit. It needs to be a hit within the first couple of months, because sometimes the shelf life in bookstores is a matter of 3 months, 6 months at the most, and then it's not even in the store anymore. So a lot of things have changed, and the financial pressures are just enormous.
No more Hemingways.
No more, oh, yeah, no more Hemingways. No more Moby Dick. I mean, do you realize that there were like 200 copies of Moby Dick in the entire world in existence at the time of Melville's death? Imagine all of the literary works that are currently being lost to us. It's a fairly depressing thing to imagine.
This one, can you hear me? So quick question, e-publishing, you want to get onto a Kindle, you want to get your book available to sell through that. How does that work for authors if you want to do it? Is that a viable option? Can a person make a career out of that? Is it a bad move? Just all of the generals on it, please, if you can. Thanks.
The Kindle market, it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out. For a publisher, as you probably noticed, most of the Kindle titles are about $9 retail, $9, $10 retail. For the publisher, that portion is about $3. So granted, you don't have to, you know, chop down a tree and run a printing press and all that stuff, but you know, that's a very small amount of money for a publisher doing niche marketing. It works well, you know, if you're publishing Harry Potter and you're churning out your next million to, you know, throw it on Kindle and sell a million copies that way. But I think for niche publishing, it's going to be a tough way to make a living just because of the razor-thin margins. Having said that, we plan on, for Christmas, trying to have a couple of titles out for Kindle, just more as an experience, not you know, as a way to fund my retirement by any means. So, but the electronic media is obviously here to stay. We're also planning on trying to put out some audio titles, just to see how that goes as well. So clearly, electronic media is going to be here for the future. But I'm enough of a Luddite to also believe there'll be some products that'll always be on paper as long as the paper can be afforded and there are trees to chop down.
So. Just to add to that, I'm very excited about the future of the Kindle, and I think it is the wave of the future. We're going to be seeing more products like that and increasing sophistication, especially with the text-to-speech capability. So don't give up on that just because the technology isn't quite there yet. We are within 5 to 10 years of a rather amazing device that could change the future of publishing.
While I was sitting and listening to you all, it was revealed to me by God and the Virgin Mary that I am the only one in the room who has reviewed for all of you. Janet doesn't know me by sight.
You're Jeff.
Yeah, I'm Jeff, yes. I worked for you for a long time. And she is tougher than you three will ever be. We'll talk more in the session, I hope. A question that you may not be able to answer, maybe Kurt's here, they would answer better, and maybe with your experience. When people walk into a Mormon bookstore like Deseret Book, I know that they buy stuff, and most of the time the wrapper never comes off. They give it as a gift, it ends up at Deseret Industries still wrapped. Do people and then I buy it. And then give it to somebody who never wants it. When people walk into a bookstore, are they going there to buy a title, they have it in their head, or are they just looking around? This is relevant to what Greg was talking about Deseret Book being upset about Siegel not having all the advertising. Are people really attracted to buy a book by these banners, or do people walk into the store saying, I'm going in to buy this, and then I'm going to walk out?
When I was running Siegel Book, about 70% of our customers were female. And of those, at least 60% of the 70 were buying a gift. I think the predominant number of male customers came in specifically after a title or a genre at a bare minimum. But, you know, so at least half the customers in the store don't have a specific title in mind. They know they're buying something for Timmy because he's going on a mission, or Uncle Ed because it's his birthday, and oh, this looks good, and I'm sure I'll like it because it's got a nice picture on the cover. So,
I had lunch with Deseret Book on Monday, and they asked me what kind of books they should send me, and I told them, here's the rule. Even if there are 101 ways to cook asparagus, I don't need to know it. Thank you.
When I was in Deseret Book, one of the issues was that people would come in looking for a gift, and they were looking for a safe gift to give to Uncle Ernie that was the appropriate gift. And Uncle Ernie would take the gift and say, yes, this is the appropriate gift. Thank you. Put it on a shelf, and it would end up in the DI in 70 or whenever you kicked off. So, if you want a book that you want to have read, the reality is that you have to do your own marketing and you have to do your own distributing, and you have to do your own promotion. I did have one guy at Deseret Book who would show up. He had his own independent little book, and I thought it was kind of cool back then. I was pretty young, and he would come in, and I knew him by sight. I didn't know if he was running by a pseudonym. But Larry came in and he said, can I set up a book signing in front? And I said, you bet, because you're going to pay all my employees' salaries tonight. And he would walk in and set his books up from his car. He'd set 100 titles up, or 100 books up. He'd wade into the mall, drag people in, and he would sell all 100 copies through my grassroots register. And I'd set him up on the invoice, and they'd pay him a month later. Because he knew how to talk to people about his book. I've had other people sit at the book, front of the bookstore with a pen in hand and sat there for an hour and a half and didn't sell a single book, didn't talk to anybody. Other guys have had bodyguards in front of them. But unless you're out. That was the one thing, cool thing about my brother. He'd go and get on these radio shows, and yeah, his book's a little goofy and stuff, but he knew how to talk to people. He would tell these fun stories and interesting stories about the childhood of Jesus, right, to the UFO guys. And, you know, they loved him, and he would sell scans of them. And if you're going to be an author, you need to think about, are you going to, you know, Judy, I don't know if Judy Busk is here, but she goes around to all these history conferences, and she pitches her book. And she tells people about it, and she walks over and puts it in her hand, and this great, she opens it up, and people walk away with their book. And if you're not willing to do that, you need to think about what it is that you're trying to do with your publishing, because really the sales are going to be about you.
I just wanted to add one thing about Jeff's quest. By the way, Jeff, it is so cool to meet you finally after all these years. Question about consumer behavior in bookstores and whether people have something specific in mind when they walk in or not. Actually, a lot of people do have something specific in mind, but most of us, myself included, are very open to persuasion when we walk into a bookstore, either substituting something or even better, adding something else. And booksellers know this, and when you walk into a major trade bookstore like a Barnes & Noble and you see the books on the front table and you stop and you look and you see what's new, you need to realize that publishers have paid a very pretty penny for that privilege of having books there. That's not just a situation where the bookseller, like in the old days, Tom was describing, the bookseller says, hey, this is a cool book. I want to sell the heck out of this book. Let's put it right up front. That is a business decision. Getting a book at all into an airport store costs money. That's a very expensive proposition. Just every book that you find in an airport bookstore has paid the privilege. You paid for that privilege of being there. So consumer behavior is endlessly studied. But it's both. It's a mix of people coming in and knowing what they want because it's been hand sold to them in some other way, like on NPR, for example, which is one of the best vehicles still for selling books. Or they read about the author in one of the incredibly shrinking book pages on the newspapers.
I want to quickly offer one bit of advice to some authors in the room and ask you folks how to maybe take this bit of advice to the next level. Something I did quite inadvertently with my first book was I was a commenter online in the community. The book was on rock climbing. I was commenting on the rock climbing forums on the internet for about 2 years before the book was published. So when finally one day I said, hey, I've got a book coming out, there was like, I didn't realize I was doing this, but there's a built-in audience that was ready and waiting to buy the book, and that took care of about the first 2,000 sales. Yeah. And then word of mouth went from there. And that's something that any author can do. It's like you don't have to, but I don't necessarily see Mormons who are commenting on the blogs and whatnot saying, you know, really establishing themselves and saying, by the way, I have a book coming out. So I definitely encourage people to use that because it was so successful. But what do you think, what's the next level? Like, how can we push that even farther?
Well, that's where Orientum and a few of these other groups have come in. You know, I do some mountaineering, and I love the mountaineering genre. You know, Greg Child comes out with a book, I'm already there, right? You know, I'm following it. And there's a much broader audience of mountaineering and rock climbing than Mormon fiction, unfortunately. And so there are groups that are...
Which is hard to believe.
But there already are groups that are gathering together their own blogs and are talking about stuff. And a really quality book comes out, yeah, there's 100 to 200 people that are paying attention and they're going to grab the book. But how do you get to the book to the next level? When you figure that out, you let me know, okay?
You know, when we say Mormon fiction, one problem that you have is that if your Mormon fiction has any kind of a worldly element to it, then people don't want you to call it Mormon fiction anymore. That just a thought that came to my mind. I've gotten books into the stores and had the stores return them because somebody read them. But the question is not that at all. It's how to do. You know, with a novel, it's hard to become an expert on the subject area. I have a book coming out by Jonathan Langford. It's just down in the couple hallways on it's kind of the first gay Mormon coming of age. It's a novel, but he has a real opportunity to become a go-to guy on that very topical area, and I'm really interested to see what he can do, reaching out to other blogs, offering to be interviewed by other blogs. You can still go to newspapers. There's something called blog tours that you can do, contests. So I think that the most success I've seen is through blogs. One good blogger gives a really good review to your book, it'll sell 100 copies. That's happened. So I don't know if that helps. But.
You know, I'd like to add that the way, as I mentioned earlier, the way publishing has changed is that it's absolutely critical for authors to have what they call a platform from the beginning. And that's what Douglas Hunter was talking about with the rock climbing example. He was already known in that community, and that made all the difference for sales. So I'd like to recommend a book. It's called Get Known Before the Book Deal. Before you ever write a book proposal, before you ever contact an editor or an agent, read that book and build your platform, because it will make its, you know, your book proposal will stand out so much more than everyone else you're competing against.
I'm just curious if you see any genre within this Mormon niche where there's still space at all, like specifically maybe along like gender or age lines, you know, young adult fiction or women's issues or whatever, if there's something where maybe it hasn't been done to death, you're not seeing it constantly. And then as a two-part question, I'm wondering if you ever like solicit from the blogger knuckle, if it makes such a difference, do you solicit manuscripts from that community?
The growth genre I hope for is more of erotica.
I don't think I can say anything to follow that. Well, the second
all the time. I don't solicit in Mormonism because the publishing house that I work for, we don't do Mormon studies. But I do solicit in the Protestant community. I absolutely solicit among academics, people who write for Christian Century. If I see something that, wow, is well written, says something fresh, I'm all over that. So get your name out there. Blogging is a fantastic, cheap, easy way to do that, and it has an immediate response. It's great.
Just this week, I still read Irianton, Sunstone, Dialogue, and the print journals. And just this week, you know, there was a story in Irianton that I really liked and sent a query to the author. So don't forget those print journals. She went ahead and sent me a whole novel manuscript, and I'm excited about it. So we can't forget those.
I'm going to give you my secret, okay? This is going to ruin my opportunity. Sunstone does Cornucopia. I've written three or four quick and dirty Cornucopian, you know, pieces, and he's accepted them and printed them the next month. That they're struggling to get pieces on that. So it's a nice way to get a nice 400 or 500 word piece published quickly and get some editing experience and you know, get some crap out of the thing that you wrote, and you know, he took my thing and reversed it, and you know, and it was fun, you know, to go through that process, and you know, it's quick and easy, and there's not a big line.
We're out of time.
In light of what Tom said, one of two things he stole from me, by the way. In light of that, Tom, I have a manuscript on Eskimo Mormon translation. I just wondered if signature would be interested or not.
Absolutely. Do not go to MJ first.
This is actually probably a question for everybody in this room, because everyone here on the panel has alluded to the fact that Mormon publishing, small press publishing, and bookselling is in a crisis. And I would like to know, for the sake of the publishers, by the way, we sell books from all of these publishers here, and I think we're one of the few that still does. What I would like to know, and I think the publishers would like to know, especially since we've talked about it, Greg was talking about, you know, we want to sell what people want to read rather than what we want to sell. What is it that we should be doing as publishers and as booksellers, as people who love the printed word? Because the printed word looks like it's not dying, and it won't die, but it's sick right now. And so what can we all do? What is everyone looking for in a bookseller or in a publisher? And of course, we have authors here and we have consumers here, because we all need to know how to survive and how, and hopefully even how to thrive. And I think all of us would welcome that kind of feedback.
You can just your books on a website.
Support your independent bookstores.
Yes.
I don't know that crisis, Kurt, is necessarily the right word for where we're at. There is interest in the printed word, and I think probably the biggest dilemma in the world that we live in of Mormon studies is that your typical Mormon doesn't even know that Mormon studies exist. I mean, their idea of radical stuff is fair, you know, because it's not sanctioned by BYU. So that, you know, that's a dilemma that we constantly face. But one of the things that I've found is, in working with Deseret Book, you know, every once in a while there's glimmers of hope and you know, rays of light. They've recognized that there is a market for titles like we publish, and in fact they recently have invited me to be a participant in this program they've got where they insert flyers and catalogs and all the stuff they're shipping out, and they limit that to just a handful of publishers. Now, I'm going to say that's because of the quality titles that we put out, And because there is a market for this stuff, my brother's going to say, pull the string for me. So it depends on which side of the table you're sitting on. But I think there is a market for this stuff. And the internet has done a fabulous job in making the information available to people who are willing to look. But the next hurdle I think we face is your average typical Mormon in my ward doesn't even know what I put out because, you know, I'm not passing out flyers and catalogs at church because my wife won't let me. But then she's back there, you know, flounder. But, you know, the trickiest part is how do we let this potentially larger market know the stuff's out there? And that's a constant battle. I don't have a magic solution to it. But, you know, every once in a while when we're able to, you know, break through the clutter, and we've had a number of our books actually make it onto the front page of the Tribune or the Deseret News, you know, when we do that, you know, the sales just are horrendous. I mean, they're just off the chart. And that's given limited distribution within just Deseret Books, Siegel, and the independents like your store. We're fairly close on cutting a deal where we'll have a very small number of titles in Sam's Club, Costco, and Walmart. And if we can get something on the front page and we've got that distribution availability, then, you know, we're going to have dramatically more sales because people will say, oh, I saw that on the paper, and here it is at Walmart, so it must be a real thing. But I don't have a magic solution for addressing the larger market.
Can I say something? Every time you put a book in Walmart between the gin and the tires, you put an independent bookseller out of business.
Just to repeat that for the record, she said that every time you put a book in Walmart between the gin and the what?
Tires.
The tires, okay. That you put an independent bookseller out of business. And there's a lot of truth to that. You know, the crisis that we've been seeing, especially in bookselling, is probably not going to go away. And 50 years from now, what bookstores do exist, it may be a situation where you walk in, you get your cup of whatever latte or whatever, hot chocolate if you live in Utah, and then you go to a kiosk and you order up the book that you're interested in, and there's nothing else in the store except the cafe and some comfy chairs and a kiosk. That's where we're headed, and some people are going to be buying books at home. So it's a time of tremendous change. It is also, to look at the glass half full, it's a time of tremendous opportunity because there's never been a time when you as authors had access to the whole publishing process yourself. Self-publishing has made that possible. Tom talked about Lightning Source. There's also Lulu.com. Tons of different sites that you can use that will, you buy a package. This package might include editorial guidance. This package might include cover design. This package might include production. There are a lot of opportunities out there. We are out of time, and I would like to thank you all for coming. We're so delighted to have you.